Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and here we are, smack dab in the middle of the dog days of summer. Which got me thinking, what does that mean exactly? Okay, we all know dog days are the hottest, most sultry days of summer. But I did a little research, and the term is actually based on the ancient belief that Sirius, the dog star, is in close proximity to the sun at this time. So, that celestial canine is responsible for all this hot weather. In honor of the dog days, we'll take a look at books starring man's best friends. There's a wonderful pack, some new, some real heartwarmers, and some classics. And since we've talked about origins of words and phrases, you're going to enjoy our guest today. She's just written a very entertaining book about words, a roundup of American regionalisms, which, to quote our friends in Massachusetts, is quite a real pissa. Let's get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Yes, this title's been out for a while, but if you haven't read it, you're in for a treat. The Art of Racing in the Rain by Garth Stein is the tale of Enzo, a philosopher pooch with a nearly human soul. Yes, I'm a dog lover, but this book is so much more. It's going to get you in the gut and in the heart. Through his master, Denny, Enzo has gained a tremendous insight into the human condition. He sees that life, like his master's passion of auto racing, isn't simply about going fast. Using techniques learned on the racetrack, one can attempt to navigate all of life's ordeals. On the eve of his death, Enzo takes stock of his life, recalling all that he and his family have been through. The sacrifices Denny made to succeed, the unexpected loss of Denny's wife, the 3-year battle over Denny's daughter Zoe when her maternal grandparents fought for custody. In the end, despite what he sees as his own limitations, Enzo comes through heroically to preserve his family, holding in his heart the dream that Denny might one day become a racing champion with daughter Zoe at his side. A heart-wrenching but ultimately uplifting story of family, love, loyalty, and hope, The Art of Racing in the Rain is a beautifully crafted and captivating look at the wonders and absurdities of human life as only a dog could tell it. Christopher Evan Welch narrates.
The door opens, and I hear him with his familiar cry, "Yo, Zoe!" Usually I can't help but put aside my pain and hoist myself to my feet, wag my tail, sling my tongue around, and shove my face into his crotch. It takes human-like willpower to hold back on this particular occasion, but I do. I hold back. I don't get up. I'm acting. "Enzo?" I hear his footsteps, the concern in his voice. He finds me and looks down. I lift my head, wag my tail feebly so it taps against the floor. I play the part. He shakes his head and runs his hand through his hair, sets down the plastic bag from the grocery that has dinner in it. I can smell roast chicken through the plastic. Tonight he's having roast chicken and an iceberg lettuce salad. "Oh, Enz," he says. He reaches down to me, crouches, touches my head like he does, along the crease behind the ear, and I lift my head and lick at his forearm. "What happened, kid?" he asks. Gestures can't explain. "Can you get up?" I try, and I scramble. My heart takes off, lunges ahead, because no, I can't. I panic. I thought I was just acting, but I really can't get up. Life imitating art. "Take it easy, kid," he says, pressing down on my chest to calm me. "I've got you." He lifts me easily, He cradles me, and I can smell the day on him. I can smell everything he's done. His work, the auto shop, where he's behind the counter all day, standing, making nice with the customers who yell at him because their BMWs don't work right and it costs too much to fix them, and that makes them mad, so they have to yell at someone. I can smell his lunch. He went to the Indian buffet he likes, all you can eat. It's cheap, and sometimes he takes a container with him and steals extra portions of the tandoori chicken and yellow rice and has it for dinner, too. I can smell beer. He stopped somewhere, the Mexican restaurant up the hill. I can smell the tortilla chips on his breath. Now it makes sense. Usually I'm excellent with elapsed time, but I wasn't paying attention because of my emoting. He places me gently in the tub and turns on the handheld shower thing and says, "Easy, Enz." He says, "Sorry I was late. I should have come straight home, but the guys from work insisted. I told Craig I was quitting," and he trails off. And I realize that he thinks my accident was because he was late. Oh, no. That's not how it was meant. It's so hard to communicate because there are so many moving parts. There's presentation, and there's interpretation, and they're so dependent on each other, it makes things very difficult. I didn't want him to feel bad about this. I wanted him to see the obvious, that it's okay for him to let me go. He's been going through so much, and he's finally through it. He needs to not have me around to worry about anymore. He needs me to free him, to be brilliant. He is so brilliant. He shines. He's beautiful with his hands that grab things and his tongue that says things and the way he stands and chews his food for so long, mashing it into a paste before he swallows. I will miss him and little Zoe, and I know they will miss me. But I can't let sentimentality cloud my grand plan. After this happens, Denny will be free to live his life, and I will return to Earth in a new form, as a man, and I will find him and shake his hand and comment on how talented he is. And then I will wink at him and say, "Enzo says hello," and turn and walk quickly away as he calls after me. "Do I know you?" he will call. "Have we met before?" After the bath, he cleans up the kitchen floor while I watch. He gives me my food, which I eat too quickly again, and sets me up in front of the TV while he prepares his dinner. "How about a tape?" he says. "Yes, a tape," I reply, but of course he doesn't hear me. He puts in a video from one of his races, and he turns it on, and we watch. It's one of my favorites. The racetrack is dry for the pace lap, and then just after the green flag is waved, indicating the start of the race, there is a wall of rain, a torrential downpour that engulfs the track, and all the cars around him spin out of control into the fields. And he drives through them, as if the rain didn't fall on him, like he had a magic spell that cleared water from his path. Just like the 1993 Grand Prix of Europe, when Senna passed four cars on the opening lap. Four of the best championship drivers in their championship cars. Schumacher, Wendlinger, Hill, Prost. And he passed them all. Like he had a magic spell.
Look at any list of all-time favorite dog books, and this one is always in the top. Merrill's Door, Lessons from a Free-Thinking Dog, was written by Ted Carasote. The author met and adopted Merle, a Labrador mix, while he was on a camping trip. Merle had been living in the wild, and after taking the dog home with him to Wyoming, Carasote soon realized that Merle could not adjust to inhabiting exclusively in the human world. So, he put a door in his house to let Merle live both inside and out. This is a deeply touching portrait of a remarkable animal. Merrill's Door explores the issues that all animals and their human companions face as their lives intertwine. It presents truly interesting research into animal behavior, as well as the origin and evolution of human-dog interaction. Merrill shows Carasote how dogs might live were they free. Carasote suggests how they should be allowed to live and the doors that should always remain open to them. Patrick Lawler narrates.
Pam was 36, an Olympic ski racer, and Bennett, 25, was trying to keep up with her. They had recently fallen in love and exuded a mixture of endorphins and pheromones. People almost never describe other people in these terms, noting first their smells, for we're primarily visual creatures and rely on our eyes for information. By contrast, the only really important sense key for the big golden dog doing his little dance in the headlights was our olfactory signatures, wafting to him as we opened the doors. It was for this reason, smell, that I think he trotted directly to my door, leaned his head forward cautiously, and sniffed at my bare thigh. What mix of aromas went up his long snout at that very first moment of our meeting? What atavistic memories, what possibilities were triggered in his canine worldview as he untangled the mysteries of my sweat? The big dog, now appearing reddish in the interior light of the truck and without a collar, took another reflective breath and studied me with excited consideration. Might it have been what I ate and the subtle residue it left in my pores that made him so interested in me? It was the only thing I could see, note my human use of see even while describing an olfactory phenomenon, that differentiated me from my friends. Like them, I skied, biked, and climbed, and was single. I had just turned 41, a compact man with chestnut hair and bright brown eyes. But when I ate meat, it was that of wild animals, not domestic ones, mostly elk and antelope, along with the occasional grouse, duck, goose, and trout mixed in. Was it their metabolized essence that intrigued him? Some whiff of what our Paleolithic ancestors had shared? Smell is our oldest sense. It was the olfactory tissue at the top of our primeval nerve cords that evolved into our cerebral hemispheres, where thought is lodged. Perhaps the dog, a being who lived by his nose, knew a lot more about our connection than I could possibly imagine. His deep brown eyes looked at me with luminous appreciation and said, "You need a dog, and I'm it." Unsettled by his uncanny read of me, I had been looking for a dog for over a year, I gave him a cordial pat and replied, "Good dog." His tail beat steadily, and he didn't move, his eyes still saying, "You need a dog." As we got out of the cars and began to unpack our gear, I lost track of him. There was his head, now a tail, there a rufous flank moving among bare legs and sandals. I threw my pad and bag down on the sand under a cottonwood, slipped into its silky warmth, turned over, and found him digging a nest by my side. Industriously, he scooped out the sand with his front paws, casting it between his hind legs before turning, and settling to face me. In the starlight, I could see one brow go up, the other down. Of course, brows isn't really the correct term, since dogs sweat only through their paws and have no need of brows to keep perspiration out of their eyes, as we do. Yet certain breeds of dogs have darker hair over their eyes, what might be called brow markings, and he had them. The Hidatsa, a Native American tribe of the northern Great Plains, believe that these sorts of dogs, whom they call four eyes, are especially gentle and have magical powers. Stanley Coren, the astute canine psychologist from the University of British Columbia, has also noted that these four-eyed dogs obtained their reputation for psychic powers because their expressions were easier to read than those of other dogs. The contrasting colored spots make the movements of the muscles over the eye much more visible. In the starlight, the dog lying next to me raised one brow while lowering the other, implying curiosity mixed with concern over whether I'd let him stay. "Night," I said, giving him a pat. Then I closed my eyes.
My guest today, Mim Harrison, is first and foremost a language lover. She developed her ear for language in college when she took her junior year abroad at the University of Hull. Mim chose England in part because she thought she spoke the language, but she quickly learned Mark Twain had been right when he described England and America as being separated by a common language. The heavy accents and rich idioms of Northern England were so foreign, Mim wondered, how could this be the same language and yet be so different? How indeed? Mim is a founding member of Levenger Press. Her books include Smart Words and Words at Work, and now there is Wicked Good Words, which we'll talk about today. Mim's also authored pieces on Winston Churchill, Robert Louis Stevenson, and Alexis de Tocqueville. Her online column, Readers on Writing, delves into the reading habits of authors. Welcome, Mim. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Well, you describe English as the great sponge of other languages. Expand on that for us.
I think that English probably borrows, begs, and steals more from other languages than any other one, and it's I think it's a great attribute of the language. It's always been a language where other languages could permeate it, and it's, you know, it started way back from the days of the Angles and the Saxons and the Normans. When the Normans came, then suddenly a lot of French terms came into our language, and we've just kind of continued that tradition. And certainly when the English came to America, they continued that tradition where they would borrow from the Native Americans for words that described things that they had never seen before or ever experienced before. So we are a good sponge, and I think it's one of the things that makes our regionalism so colorful.
Well, you published an abridged edition of Samuel Johnson's Dictionary of 1755. Tell us why that project.
The Johnson Dictionary was something that I first discovered when I was actually editing another book on language that referenced it. And I had never heard of it, which now, in retrospect, I can't believe that I hadn't heard of it. But when I did some research on it, I discovered that the Johnson Dictionary of 1755, although it was not the first dictionary of the English language, it was the first dictionary that made the English language accessible, the definitions accessible to more people. And it defined some of the everyday words and not just all of these very peculiar, strange words that would often go into dictionaries. And the Johnson Dictionary became the quote, Bible of dictionaries for years, not only in England, but also in the early days of America, when Jefferson was writing his Declaration of Independence. He was actually using an English dictionary, which I think is a wonderful irony.
And what year did Noah Webster, join the fray?
He got into it in the early 1800s. And, of course, Noah Webster wanted Americans to speak and to spell like Americans rather than like the English. And so we have him to thank for the fact that we spell color without a U, for instance, and that we do have, a number of the words in our language that were not in the American language that were not necessarily in the English language.
Well, in Wicked Good Words, you have sections on each part of the country, including Alaska and Hawaii. So did you spend months in each part of the country researching?
Well, I wish I could have spent months in each part of the country. I did spend months researching, though. And although I've been to many parts of the country that are covered in the book, I didn't get to all of them. So Alaska and Hawaii, I basically compiled from research and also from some people who I knew who had visited these places as well.
Mm-hmm. With TV as the mass medium, are regionalisms going to fade away?
I think that regionalisms have started to fade away, and probably a good test of that is if we talk to our grandparents or even our great-grandparents and realize that there are expressions that they use that we don't use anymore. We just don't hear them anymore. So I think that it's a lot of things. It's our mass media. It's also our mobility. You know, people in this country move around a lot. We still do that. But what I found encouraging was that there are still as many regionalisms as there are, And there were two things that I found amusing. When I was working on the book, if I asked someone to tell me something unusual or specific to your part of the world that you say, you get kind of the deer in the headlights. It's like, well, we don't say anything funny. And then when my book came out, all of a sudden people would say, well, did you include this and did you include that? And we've always said this and whatever. So I think there are still a lot of regional expressions that kind of bubble up in people once you get them going on it.
Yeah. Are regionalisms popping up in email and text messages?
I think it's hard in text messages. I think text messaging is its own language, quite honestly. It's a language of acronyms. And I think it would be hard to regionalize them, quite honestly. Especially, you know, some of the southern regionalisms are, you know, they're a little bit longer to get the full appreciation of them. And email, I've done a lot of email and corresponded with a lot of people on email, and I've never experienced any of them using a regionalism. So I think it's a talking phenomenon. I think it's a conversational phenomenon, and that's a very good thing that we still have these quote old-fashioned conversations where we're actually using our voice and talking to one another.
How did you decide which terms to put in and which terms to omit?
That was very difficult, and it's difficult especially when you go to the Dictionary of American Regional English, which is the Bible on regionalisms, and it's 5 volumes, and so you realize that there are millions of regionalisms in the country. What I tried to do was to find terms that I could corroborate. If I found them in a book, I wanted to be able to find them in places on the web. I wanted to find people who used them. Not all of them, but most of them. I also looked at some of the older regionalisms, which have kind of faded away, but some of them are neat terms and maybe we want to bring back.
Like, tell us a few.
Well, for instance, in New England, probably a lot of people there would not know what a moon cusser was, even though it's very much a part of the maritime heritage of New England. And the moon cusser was the person who, actually, it was the person who would go out on a stormy night and would shine a lantern as a way to confuse a ship so that the ship would think it was a lighthouse and would come in, would basically end up being grounded, and then the moon cussers would go and scavenge the ship. Hmm. But if the moon were out, if it were a full moon, then the captain of the ship could see that the light was bogus, and so that wouldn't happen.
Well, I think that your book is a great resource for writers who are writing convincing dialogues. What other books would you suggest aspiring writers resource for their dialogues?
For their dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, oddly enough, it's not going to give them dialogue per se, but I actually think it's worth a skim of a Johnson dictionary. And in one of the ways it's good is if a writer is... If what he or she is writing about is set in the 18th century, because a lot of the words had somewhat different meanings to them. And one of the things I discovered in publishing that abridged edition was that there are lawyers in constitutional law who still refer to Johnson's dictionary to see what certain words meant at the time that the Constitution was written. So I think that's quite interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to ask you, this particular show is called The Dog Days of Summer.
Yeah.
So talk about that Ozark expression, that dog won't hunt.
That was one that I had heard some friends say to me for a number of years, and I just thought it was marvelous. And some of it, of course, I think you have to have a good accent to really kind of carry it off. But you know, dogs kind of have a lot of strong imagery, and that particular expression, that dog won't hunt, we know that it's been around since at least the 1930s, and it's now, you hear it in a lot of parts of the South now. And it basically means this won't work. So, and then you'll hear the opposite too, you know, that dog will hunt, meaning, oh, this is a good thing, this will work for me.
I like it.
Yeah.
So what's your next project?
My next project is, I'm sure it's going to have something to do with words, because I, American / English words. I do think that our language is just a marvel of contradictions, and so that makes it a treasure trove in many ways. And I'm fascinated with the origins of words, because I think the origins tell you not just about the word, but they tell you about the time and they tell you about the people. So probably something along those lines.
All right. Mim, what's the favorite word you uncovered in your dictionary? And
that's a tough one, because there were so many. But the expression that I really liked was Sputnik grass.
All right. What's that?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, because I didn't know what it was either. It's a type of seaweed that the fisher people of Long Island, who are called the Bonnocks, christened in 1957, and it was, of course, because that was when Sputnik was all pervasive in the world. So it became known as Sputnik grass.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Bye, Mim.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Susan Wilson's One Good Dog begins with Adam Marsh at the top of his game, master of his universe. He's got it all. The beautiful wife, the high-powered job, the glittering circle of friends. But one day, Adam makes a fatal mistake. His assistant leaves him a three-word message: your sister called. What no one knows is that Adam's sister had been missing for decades, that she represents the excruciatingly painful past he'd left behind, and that her absence has been a torment. When a conversation about this message with his assistant goes awry, Adam loses it and all hell breaks loose. Adam is escorted from the building. He loses his job. He loses his wife. He loses the life he's worked so hard to achieve. When he is assigned to work in a soup kitchen as a form of community service, he believes he's hit rock bottom. But unbeknownst to Adam, this is where his life will intersect with Chance. Chance is a mixed breed pit bull. The dog was born and raised to fight and is seldom allowed to leave the dirty basement where he is kept between fights. But Chance is not a victim or a monster. It is Chance's unique spirit that helps the dog escape and puts him in the path of Adam. What transpires is the story of one man, one dog, and how they save each other. Fred Berman and Rick Adamson narrate.
Adam sorts through the array of newspapers fanned out across the long counter as if he's choosing the right cut of meat. Behind the counter, lottery tickets are on display, the true meat and drink of the small store. There is a coffee service, a double-burner stainless steel maker offering one glass pot of regular and another of decaf. The regular is fresh. There is profit in being an early riser. And Adam helps himself to a large cup. He picks up a package of peanut butter crackers, which have become his breakfast of choice. $4.75. The proprietor shifts his cigar to the other side of his mouth. Adam digs out three crumpled bills and makes up the rest in coins. Coins he should have saved for his laundry. He's got to make an ATM stop sometime today. See if he can get by on 100 till next week. Maybe he better do it before the sentencing. The sentencing. A wave of dismay percolates through him. The hand holding the coin trembles slightly, as if Adam is standing on the platform as a train blasts through. Will the judge send him to jail? It wasn't an outright assault, despite what Sophie kept slipping into the testimony. It was a slap. She wasn't really traumatized. That whole bit about counseling and fear of men is hogwash. He isn't a danger to anyone. He hasn't made it impossible for her to work. Her leave of absence from Dynamic is a sham. The accusations and effect of his, albeit stupid, action had risen in graduated levels of absurdity as the trial went on. Adam takes in a breath, letting the pain of breathing distract him from his line of thinking. Lately, he has experienced pain like that from cracked ribs, as if he'd been the one attacked. Do you have anything stronger than aspirin? The proprietor gestures toward a small display of patent medicines and shrugs.
Tylenol, Advil, the usual stuff. My wife likes Aleve.
Adam studies the boxes, reads the ingredients, thinks back on the various commercial claims each one professes, and then checks the price. You take credit cards?
$10 limit.
Adam gathers one of each brand into his arms and dumps them on the counter with his paper and the coffee.
Thanks, pal.
The proprietor bags his stuff and hands the plastic bag to him. Outside, Adam shoves his papers under his arm, shifts the plastic bag of drugs. Glancing next door, he sees the tropical fish store woman unlocking her door. She's dressed in low-rise jeans and a tank top that just about touches the waistband. Her hair is still damp from her shower or from the early heat, and it hangs in gentle waves to her shoulders and is the color of molasses. She nods to him, a fellow early bird. Adam has seen her before, just not this close. He spends a great deal of his day watching the street from his bolt hole of an apartment. He's watched her perform what seems to be a daily ritual of washing her front window, a willowy undulation side to side, up and down, as she squeegees the plate glass with her long pulled blade. What can he say to her? He feels a little like a voyeur face to face with his object. Up close, she's older than he thought. Not a girl, despite her youthful clothes, but a woman maybe in her late 30s, early 40s. Adam hesitates too long and she disappears into the shop. Taking a sip of his coffee, Adam waits to take advantage of a lull in the increased morning traffic. A moment later, the woman reappears, her hair bundled back out of the way with an elastic, a bucket of water in hand.
Morning.
There. He's established that he's a human being. She gives him the wary look of a woman alone on a city sidewalk, and he becomes conscious of his scrappy attire.
Morning.
Nothing more. She turns to her window washing. Hot again. Points for having a conversation. Points off for being platitudinal.
Sure is.
Her accent is tipped with some flavor not from here.
Southern?
Midwestern? Keep cool.
You too?
Sure. A hot courtroom, his destination. An unknown penalty. A life off the rails. He's cool. Absolutely.
They spotted the dead dog first. The rest of us, Mom, Dad, and two others, were shocked into a momentary silence before coming to our senses and barking invectives at the men and the woman. She's the one who knelt over the body of my late challenger, running her hand gently down his side as if he might enjoy the feeling. I stopped my noise to watch. Two uniformed men and one woman stood in our cellar and swore grandly at what they had come to see. It was a little stagey, their response, as if they were pleased to have been proven correct, that they had chosen well. I yarked. Mom and Dad shrank to the back of their cages. One of the others actually growled, catching the attention of the men, who stopped swearing and grimaced with some decision. I yarked some more, a little uncertain and more than curious. What did this visit really mean? The men carried poles with loops of line sticking out of their hollow cores. The woman seemed more confident and unlatched the cage containing my mother and my siblings. Mom shrank back but was silent, which the woman took for a good thing. Come on, Mommy, I won't hurt you. I stopped my yarking, wanting to hear more of this voice. Fitty, my dad, sat down and did something that was extraordinary in my mind, something I had never seen him do, but I understood immediately the reason for it. He put one paw up against the mesh of his cage front, an imploring, hey, I'm with you sort of gesture. The men visibly relaxed. The woman tentatively held out a hand to Mom. Mom wasn't having any of it and pressed herself even deeper into the cage. In her experience, someone wanting her out of her cage meant only two things, a fight or a... The woman snapped her fingers softly and made a clucking noise with her mouth, a sweet little kissy noise. Mom sighed. Capitulation. Slowly, my mother made her way to the woman's hand, sniffing it with wariness, wanting to be trusted. Once Mom was out of the cage, a collar around her neck and a man's strong hand hanging onto her leash, the woman gently handed out the six pups into a big box. I yarked a question to the room. What's going to happen? No one answered because no one knew. Mom cast a look in my direction, her tail swinging gently to and fro in a clear message. Whatever it is has got to be better than this minute. Dogs are existentialists. We think of now. But we do have a capacity for learning, which is predicated on our understanding of the past, not as some block of time, but as an action, a pain, a smell. Our idea of the future is limited to hunger pains, I will eat, and anticipation of a walk at a certain time every day. Those of us removed from that cellar that day lacked the imagination to picture a happy place. We knew only that things were going to be different. Eventually, they came to me. Mom and Dad and the kitties were all boxed or muzzled. The growling dog had been silenced with a little happy juice, and the other dog was acting all goofy and happy to see you. I took a hint from him. I didn't want one of those muzzles on me. I suffer a bit from claustrophobia. Ah, 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 I said, cranking the length of my tail into raptures. We gladiator types look amazingly happy when we loll our tongues and split our jaws into grins. The men and the woman bought my act. They slipped a loop around my neck, and we all headed up the narrow stairs to the first floor. I'd never been up there. It reeked of boys' sweat and a pungent smoke. Pizza boxes lay on the floor, tantalizingly out of reach from my nose. As I was constrained by the rigid pole one of the men had in his grip, beer cans were neatly stacked in a pyramid beneath the cracked window in the otherwise empty room. I didn't get to look around for very long, as we were quickly hustled out of the place and into the street.
A highly decorated captain in the U.S. Army, Luis Montalvan, never backed down from a challenge during his two tours of duty in Iraq. After returning home from combat, the pressures of his physical wounds, traumatic brain injury, and crippling post-traumatic stress disorder took their toll. Haunted by the war and in constant physical pain, he soon found himself unable to climb a simple flight of stairs or face a bus ride to the VA hospital. He drank. He argued. Ultimately, he cut himself off from those he loved. Alienated and alone, unable to sleep or bend over without pain, he began to wonder if he'd ever recover. Then Luis met Tuesday, a golden retriever trained to assist the disabled. Tuesday had lived amongst prisoners and at a home for troubled boys. The dog could turn on lights, open doors, even sense the onset of anxiety and flashbacks. But because of a unique training situation and an extremely sensitive nature, the dog found it difficult to trust humans until he was paired with Luis. Until Tuesday, written and narrated by Montalvan, is the story of how the two wounded warriors, who had given so much and suffered the consequences, found salvation in each other. It's a story about war and peace, injury and recovery, but more than that, it's a story about the love between a man and a dog and how together they healed each other's souls.
And I swear I spent hours wanting to throw my arms around them and protect them from the world. We all did, even Tuesday. But she was tough as nails, too. As Mary wrote of her experiences in a bomb disposal unit in Iraq, I was shot at, sniped, stabbed, smashed, run over, blown up four times, rocketed, mortared, had to clear sites that my friends were just killed at, had an Iraqi man try to buy me, and had an ovarian cyst rupture, all before having an IED go off while holding it, taking off my arms. It was a litany of trauma, wounds, and pride that only a soldier could understand, and only the strong could endure. You don't give up easily after experiences like that. You don't talk much about them, either. And then, on the fourth or fifth day at ECAD, Mary came waltzing in with Remy and threatened to beat Ricky and me to death with her stumps. Her word, stumps. That's the fighting spirit of an American soldier. That's a testament to the power of service dogs. They're psychological bodyguards. They make you feel secure and comfortable merely by their presence, especially in the honeymoon period when you first get them. They are the embodiment of your new and better life. They give you confidence when there was little but doubt and anxiety before. That is not to say my days at ECAD with Tuesday were easy. I had classes at Columbia most days, so the schedule was grueling. Drill, 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 then off to class, take a break, then drill some more. Tuesday was trained, but I was not, and I had only 2 weeks to learn the basics of a new life. It was hours of frustration, punctuated by short bursts of accomplishment and joy. Tuesday knew 80 commands, and that's a lot to remember for a human being, especially one with PTSD, and especially when Lou kept raising the bar for success. When I finally learned heel and side, and we became competent at walking together, Lou added other commands. Tell him to climb onto the box. Stop, Tuesday. Good boy. Jump on. He knows the box. You can just say box. Now tell him to look out the window. Let's go, Tuesday. Good boy. Heel. Heel. Window. He doesn't know window. What do you think we teach him here, Luis? Up, Tuesday. That's a window. Window. Good boy. Now try your cane. Look, Tuesday. Get my cane. That's it. Get it. That's right. Bring it here. Good boy. Lou and her staff tried their best to disrupt us. They opened doors as we walked past or dropped treats in Tuesday's path that he was supposed to ignore. We were told to use the go command, which tells Tuesday the next commands will be given from a distance, then distracted him with wheelchairs, chew toys, the mailman — she wanted to see how Tuesday would react to a stranger — other dogs, and umbrellas. The world is a complicated place. Out there, an umbrella suddenly opening was the least of the distractions. On the fourth day, when Ricky and Andrew were matched with their dogs, we started walking around the campus at Children's Village. The next day, we took a van to a local mall for public practice, then returned to walk around the table in the big room at ECAD, following the ever-present painted yellow line. It was a topsy-turvy time, both highly stressful and blissfully freeing. Sometimes it felt like Tuesday and I were making progress. Other times it seemed we were losing the basic commands we had mastered 3 days before.
The Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, Susanna Charleston was so impressed by the newspaper photo of an exhausted handler with his search and rescue dog, she decided to train a dog of her own. A dog lover and a pilot with search experience herself, Charleston got Puzzle, a golden retriever who, from the start, exhibited a unique aptitude for search and rescue work. Charleston narrates her own story in Scent of the Missing, her adventures with Puzzle, and the complex relationship they forge as they help in the pursuit and recovery of people who have fallen prey to crime, misadventure, or catastrophe, including searching for signs of the crew amid the debris of the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. Let's listen.
A third man has more difficulty. He is elderly and not as fast. He has been lying on a bare set of box springs set flat beneath the canopy of trees, and when he rises, the worn cloth of his trousers catches on the coils. We hear rending fabric as he jerks free. He runs in a different direction from the other two. Not their companion, I think. And a few yards away, he stops and turns to peek through the scrub at us, as though aware the dog is not fierce and we aren't in pursuit. Our search has disturbed a small tent city. And as we work our way through the reclaimed box springs and three-legged coffee tables and mouse-eaten recliners that have become a sort of home for its inhabitants, the third man watches our progress from the edge of the brush. This is a well-lived space, but there is nothing of the missing girl here. Charged on this search to find any human scent in the area, living or dead, Hunter has done what he is supposed to do, but he watches our response. From where I stand, it is clear Hunter knows what we found is not what we seek, and that what we seek isn't here. He gazes at Max, reading him, his eyebrows working, stands poised for the find more command. Sector clear, I say into the radio after a signal from Max. I mention the tent city and its inhabitants and learn it is not a surprise. Good boy, says Max. Hunter's stance relaxes. As we move away, the third man gains confidence. He steps a little forward, watching Hunter go. He is barefoot and shirtless. "Dog, dog, dog," he says voicelessly, as though he shapes the word but cannot make the sound of it. "Dog," he rasps again, and smiles wide and claps his hand. Saturday night in a strange town 500 miles from home, I am sitting in a bar, clearly tacked on to our motel as an afterthought. The clientele here are jammed against one another in the gloom, all elbows and ball caps bent down to their drinks, more tired than social. At the nearby pool table, a man makes his shot, trash-talks his opponent, and turns to order another beer without having to take more than four steps to get it. This looks like standard procedure. The empty bottles stack up on a nearby shelf that droops from screws half pulled out of the wall. Two men dominate the table while others watch. The shots get a little wild, the trash talk sloppier. A half hour ago, when I walked in with a handful of teammates, every head in the bar briefly turned to regard us, then turned away in perfect synchronization, their eyes meeting and their heads bobbing a nod. We are strangers and out of uniform, but they know who we are and why we are here, and besides, they've seen a lot of strangers lately. Now, at the end of the second week of search for a missing local girl, they leave us alone. We find a table, plop down without discussion, and a waitress comes out to take our orders. She calls several of us honey and presses a hand to the shoulder of one of us as she turns away.
New York Times bestselling author John Katz has written a successful series of mystery novels, nonfiction works, and a popular series based on his experiences with dogs on his farm. In Rose in a Storm, Rose is a working dog devoted to keeping the sheep and other creatures at Bedlam Farm out of danger. But as the weather grows cold, Rose senses danger, a storm unlike any she's seen. When an epic blizzard finally strikes, Rose needs all her courage to help her master save the farm. Tom Stetschulte narrates this charming heartwarmer.
"I think you love that dog more than me," Katie would sometimes joke. Sam would blush and stammer. "She's just a dog," he would say, because he couldn't say what Rose truly meant to him. Now he could tell from the urgency of Rose's bark that something was wrong. She kept tilting her ears to the pasture, agitated, eager to get outside. So on this cold and windswept night, Sam, a tall, thin man with what had once been a ready smile and a full head of reddish-brown hair, went downstairs and got a flashlight, pulled on a jacket and boots, and he and Rose walked out the back door and into the night. Even in the dark, in the reflected light of the moon, he could see the glow of her fiercely bright blue eyes. The farmhouse sat at the bottom of a gentle rolling pasture. By the back door, there were two paths. The one to the left led out into the woods, and the one to the right ran toward the two barns and the pasture gates. The first barn was big, filled with hay up in the loft and tractors and sometimes cows down below. A shed was attached to the big barn, which housed equipment and supplies as well as some feed. Farther up the hill was a large pole barn, a three-sided structure with the fourth side open to the air. It allowed the sheep to be outside, which they preferred, while still offering some shelter from the elements. When they were kept inside a closed barn, they got fearful, claustrophobic, bleated day and night. Anyway, it was the way Sam's father had done it. The three buildings formed a triangle, the farmhouse at the bottom, the big barn off to one side nearby, the pole barn 100 yards up the hill. The cows were in the other pasture on the far side of the barn. A few hundred feet from the farmhouse, the path led to a gate that connected to a fence encircling all of the pastures and barns. Sam was proud of that fence. He'd spent years shoring and patching it, and in the past year or so, no animal had slipped out or in. As they neared the barn, Sam finally saw in the beam of light from his flashlight what Rose had heard and sensed up behind the building. He moved faster, opening the pasture gate. Rose raced through and ran to the struggling ewe. Sam retrieved a sack of medical equipment from the barn and hurried behind the dog up a path well-worn by the animals, marked by manure and ice-encrusted mud, pungent even in winter. The big barn was on the right, looming like a great battleship, its lights sending small beams out into the dark, foggy pasture. That old barn had a lot of stories to tell.
We know Dean Kunst as a prolific writer of thrillers, some suspense, horror, mystery, even science fiction. But in A Big Little Life, a memoir of a joyful dog named Trixie, Kunst changes directions and writes and narrates a profound, funny, and beautifully rendered portrait of a beloved companion, the golden retriever who changed his life. A retired service dog, Trixie was 3 when Dean and his wife welcomed her into their home. She was superbly trained, but her greatest gifts couldn't be taught. Her keen intelligence, her innate joy, and an uncanny knack for living in the moment. Whether chasing a tennis ball or protecting those she loved, Trixie gave all she had to everything she did, inspiring Dean and his family to trust their instincts and recapture a sense of wonder that will always remain with them. Trixie lived fewer than 12 years. In this wide world, she was a little thing. But in every way that mattered, she lived a big life. Let's listen.
I can say that I frequently saw in her eyes a yearning to make herself understood in a complex way that only speech could facilitate. Staring into Trixie's eyes, I was sometimes silent, but at other times talked to her about my day, my problems, whatever came into my head. Those who love dogs know well this kind of rap. Dogs swim through a sea of human speech, listening attentively for words they recognize, patiently striving to interpret what we say, although most of it is, and always will be, incomprehensible to them. No human being would have such patience. Counting the many commands she had been taught when in training to be an assistance dog, and all that she had learned on her own, cookie, chicken, walk, duck, step stool, oil, painting, restoration, electromagnetism, her vocabulary was at least 100 words. It would more than double over the years. This got me to thinking. The recognition that words have meaning, the desire to remember them, the intention to act on those that are understood, does all of this lead to the conclusion that the dog also yearns to speak? On that January night, I said playfully, "You're not just a dog. You can't fool me. I know what you really are." As if in response, she raised her head, eased back slightly, and regarded me with what might have been concern. I was amused to interpret her look as meaning, "Uh-oh, somehow I've blown my cover." "You're really an angel," I continued. To my surprise, she scrambled to her feet as if in alarm, ran down the hall, turned, and stared back at me. Muscles tensed, legs spread for maximum balance, head lifted, she seemed to be waiting for what I might say next. I'm seldom speechless. Trixie's behavior, which seemed to be a reaction to my words, as if she understood every one of them, raised the fine hairs on the nape of my neck and left me mute. Intrigued, I got to my knees, wondering what she would do next, but she only stared. She continued to watch me intently when I rose to my feet. For a minute or two, we studied each other from a distance of 20 feet, as though we both expected something of consequence to happen. "Trixie?" I finally asked, and when I spoke, she retreated another 10 or 15 feet and turned again to face me in the same expectant stance. Except at night, when she preferred her bed to ours, this was not a dog who wanted solitude or even distance. The closer she could be to us, the happier she appeared. This was the first and last time she wanted distance from me. As we stared at each other, I realized that, regardless of what Trixie's behavior implied, if it implied anything, I should not pursue this matter further, if only because it disturbed her. Besides, I was dealing here with the ineffable, the pursuit of which offers endless frustration, but no reward except the thrill of the chase.
New York York Times bestselling author Alexander McCall Smith, and you know I love him, brings his peerless wit to The Dog Who Came In From the Cold, his second in the series featuring a motley collection of residents in London's Pimlico neighborhood. Literary agent Barbara Ragg has agreed to represent a man writing a book about his experiences hanging out with the abominable snowman. Terrence Moongrove's residence has become the target of New Age cosmologists. And pint-sized terrier Freddie de la Haye is being recruited by the M16 to infiltrate a Russian spy ring. Sounds like fun? You betcha. This title is narrated by Simon Preble.
Chapter 1. What Our Furniture Says About Us. William French, wine merchant, master of wine, failed somewhere in his early 50s, hardly noticeably, particularly in the right light. Loyal subscriber to rural living, although he lived quite happily in central London. Long-time supporter of several good causes. He was a kind man at heart, with a strong sense of fairness. Widower, dog owner, and much else besides. The same William French looked about his flat in Corduroy Mansions as anybody might survey his or her flat in a moment of self-assessment, of stock-taking. There was a lot wrong with it, he decided, just as he felt there was a lot that was not quite right with his life in general. Sorting out one's flat, though, is often easier than sorting out oneself, and there's a great deal to be said for first getting one's flat in order before attempting the same thing with one's life. Perhaps there was an adage for this, a pithy Latin expression akin to mens sana in corpore sano, which made him think. Everybody knew that particular expression, of course. Everybody, that is, except William's 28-year-old son, Eddie, who had once rendered it within his father's hearing as, "Men's saunas lead to a healthy body." William had been about to laugh at this ingenious translation, redolent as it was of the cod Latin he had found so achingly funny as a 12-year-old boy. Caesar ad sum iam forte, Pompey ad erat, Pompey sick in omnibus, Caesar sick in art. Caesar had some jam for tea, Pompey had a rat, and so on. But then he realized that Eddie was serious. The discovery that Eddie had no knowledge of Latin had depressed him. He knew that the overwhelming majority of people had no Latin and didn't feel the lack of it. The problem with Eddie, though, was that not only did he not have Latin, he had virtually nothing else either. No mathematics worthy of the name, no geography beyond a knowledge of the location of various London pubs, no knowledge of biology or any of the other natural sciences, no grasp of history. When it came to making an inventory of what Eddie knew, there was really very little to list. He put his son out of his mind and returned to thinking about the proposition, mens sano in corpore sano. Was there an equivalent, he wondered, to express the connection between an ordered flat and an ordered life? Vita ordinata in domo ordinata. It sounded all right, he felt. Indeed, it sounded rather impressive. But he found himself feeling a little bit unsure about the Latin. Domus was feminine, was it not? And was it not one of those fourth declension nouns where there was an alternative ablative form, domu rather than domo? William was not certain, and so he put that out of his mind, too. He walked slowly about his flat, moving from room to room, thinking of what would be necessary to reform it completely. Starting in the drawing room, he looked at the large oriental carpet that dominated the centre of the room. It was said that some such carpets gained in value as the years went past, but he couldn't see this happening to his red Baluch carpet, which was beginning to look distinctly tattered at the edges. Then there was the furniture, and here there was no doubt that the chairs, if once they'd been fashionable, no longer were. If there was furniture that spoke of its decade, then these chairs positively shouted the 70s, a period in which, it was generally agreed, design lost its way.
Well, I loved putting this show together. Hope you found some titles you'd like to... fetch. make sure to check out my website, bookreportradio.com, for tips on which titles are worth your time. Thanks for listening, and we'll do it again next week on The Book Report. Cup of hate.